Did you make it to the Trinity Book Fair this year?
No, I didn't, because, you know, our girls are gone. Or, I mean, I only had one girl there, but she's... they didn't send me a notice. I would have gone up anyway. They're in college now, my girls. Just Ma and me and the telly left.
Fortunate.
Yeah, well, I don't know, in a way. We kind of miss them. We see them a lot. I mean, they're
well, I miss the Trinity myself this year. I usually go. It's just as well that I didn't, because right. I always wind up buying something more expensive than I should afford.
Yeah. There's something I really regret not buying at the Trinity Book Fair a couple of years ago when I was the volunteer wheeler around of the food cart. Somebody had undoubtedly stolen from a library, or maybe the library folded, some bound volumes of the New Yorker from around the 40s, the 30s. There were about four or five of them. And I thought, I should have bought those. They cost about $25 a piece. I should have bought them, because we have a kind of a guest house in that we made out of the barn in Nova Scotia. Or it's a barn, really, kind of made into a guest house. And but what a nice thing to put next to people's beds, you know, when they're visiting. Just, you know, leaf through there, see some old cartoons, read a Thurber story or something.
I saw a whole run of the American Mercury circa 1920, or mid-20s, when Mencken was editing it.
Yeah.
And I was at the Hudson's Book Guild. You know, they have a great fair there, book fair there. And I guess it was kind of expensive. I mean, $75,
yeah.
Maybe $50. But since I later wrote a little book that was published last year by St. Martin's Press about Mencken, I would have loved to have had those magazines.
I have a lot of Mencken stuff. I have a lot of, but books, really, not, I mean, I have even, you know, a little thing he wrote about Christmas in Baltimore or something, and a lot of Mencken, not much about Mencken, but a lot of Mencken stuff, right?
Well, let's talk about Calvin Trillin and his new book. This is not the first time Alice has appeared on the in the title of one of your books, is it?
No, it's kind of embarrassing. In fact, the last time was 10 years ago in a book called Alice Let's Eat, which was the second book of three books I wrote about eating. We sometimes call the Tummy Trilogy. It's a little bit embarrassing to have your wife's name in the title 10 years later, because, as you probably know, long-term marriage is now strongly connected in the public mind with the music of Lawrence Welk. And to acknowledge that you're not only married but still naming books after people is considered very square. Actually, somebody at the New Yorker once asked me who I was dedicating a book to. The book was just about to come out, and I said, to Alice. And he said, no. Always a terrible mistake, dedicating a book to your wife. He said, the lead time is too long. But we've...
Can't you use a pseudonym, somebody else's name?
Well, actually, Alice wasn't sure how she felt about having her
about
name
Lillian,
in the title.
Lillian Hillman.
Right. Right. At Alice Let's Eat, she was kind of... had said at one point, when we were just about to publish the book, she wasn't sure what she felt like about having a book with her name in the title. So I said, well, we could call it Nancy Let's Eat or Carol Let's Eat.
Right.
She decided Alice Let's Eat was okay.
Well, let's talk about a couple of things that are in Travels with Alice. For example, in the opening essay, you talk about making time on the road, which seems to be a favorite custom of Americans. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I used to travel around the country with my parents when I was a child. We lived in Kansas City, which the real estate people would call equally convenient to either coast. So sometimes we came this way toward New York, but most of the time we went west. And we never had any reservations or anything like that, but it was assumed that you'd want to make a certain number of miles a day, get 500 miles under your belt or 400 miles. And I think that's a kind of a general goal-oriented way of Americans traveling. And I realized at one point Americans travel across this country as if somebody's chasing them, that they have to be somewhere. And that sort of traveling has always struck me as more like a forced march to the sea than a vacation. So our family's always been... without ever making a policy about it, we've just been kind of slow. we don't cover much ground.
Besides that, in your past, there have always been some roadside excursions that you've enjoyed.
Well, I've always, one of my great frustrations of my youth was that I couldn't persuade my father that he should stop at every roadside zoo that said, see albino raccoon. I can't imagine how a man could pass up an albino raccoon. My father passed up a number of these. He occasionally stopped. I don't know what's happened now to all the albino raccoons. Every time I see one of those lists of endangered species, now that there's no more call for an albino raccoon, since the roadside zoos have pretty much disappeared along with Route 66, five-legged goats probably are on the endangered species list now. Nobody wants a five-legged goat anymore. But I always so wanted to stop at these. And, of course, I was constantly arguing with my sister in the back seat. I think a lot of people have had this experience who've been involved in family travel. My sister and I had a careful line down the middle of the back seat, and there were some incursions. I believe what the people in the State Department call incursions. There were constant incursions by my sister. My father would be in the front seat, pointing out buttes and mesas, and we would be kind of arguing in the back seat over territory. It was kind of like the border between Finland and the Soviet Union. I played Finland. And then also I was at a terrible disadvantage because my father, in what we now know, was a terribly regressive and politically incorrect thing to say, told me, we do not hit girls, and therefore you are never to hit your sister again. I won't go into the again part of this, but so I was kind of like a unilaterally disarmed Finland.
That's right.
She was a Soviet Union bristling with weaponry. We spent a lot of time traveling that way across the western United States. I would say if it hadn't been for my sister's expansionist backseat policies, I would probably now know the difference between a butte and a mesa.
Well, things certainly improved for you as you became an adult and married Alice. You and Alice traveled together, you and your two sisters, daughters. One of your favorite places to travel, the south of France, where you actually saw a bull in a swimming pool?
Yes, that was Toro Piscine is the name of the sport. As you may know, there's a kind of a version of bullfighting in the south of France. It doesn't have anything at all to do with Spanish bullfighting.
No, I didn't. I had no idea until I read your book that they actually fought bulls in the south of France.
Yes. I think fight might be
first I thought it was a bunch of bull, but then I read on.
No, not at all. They kind of organized an official part of the sport, which is played kind of regularly through a season with the papers telling you who's leading in the same way that they might tell you who's leading in the golf tours as far as money winning. Is a version of bullfighting that shouldn't be called fighting, really. It consists of a bull coming into a ring with a kind of a bouquet on its horn, a cocarde it's called. And the bullfighter is dressed more or less like a highlight player. And he tries to circle in front of the bull and with a little comb grab the cocarde off the bull's horn and then jump out of the ring before the bull can express his displeasure. The bullfighter has no sword or cape or anything. And I'd like to tell you that this more civilized, humane, non-macho, ritualistic form of bullfighting is more interesting than the Spanish bullfighting, but in fact, a little of it goes a long way. I find it kind of boring. But sometimes there are games that are done maybe during a fiesta to entertain the townsfolk on the day before the big professionals come in. And this is one of those, Toro Piscine. And when I first saw it on a sign on a tree, I recognized both those words, Toro Piscine, and it looked to me like bull's swimming pool. And that is, in fact, what it is. It's a game that I admire partly for the elegant simplicity of its rules. There's really only one rule. If you and the bull are in the swimming pool at the same time, you win. That's it. And I was fortunate enough, and I was able to report this in this book for those who don't think it's really intrepid investigative reporting, I was able to find the inventor of Toro Piscine. I compared it to a baseball writer suddenly being told that he might like to have a beer with Abner Doubleday, talk about the invention of bases. So I went down to this fellow's kind of ranch and spoke to him. He also was the inventor of Toro football, another interesting game in the south of France. Toro football, and they mean football in the European sense, what we call soccer, is a regular game of football. The only difference is that it's played in a bull ring and there's a bull in the ring. Otherwise, the usual rules apply.
But the swimming pool facet of this game, what happens at the end? Do they dredge the pool?
Well, no, it's really just a very shallow swimming pool. It looks like one of those little wading pools people put out in back of the tract houses for the kids to wade around in. But it's actually formed with hay bales and a tarp. Mm. So the bull can actually run through the pool. It's only a couple of feet deep. And the young men, they have a variety of strategies. Some of them stand in the pool. They remind me, the ones who stand in the pool, which isn't really a very effective strategy, they look like those very awkward centers in the early days of tall men basketball, when tall people first started to come into the game of basketball, I guess probably in the 50s or 40s. And they were 6'8", and they couldn't move. And they stood under the basket, pretty much, hoping for somebody to throw them the ball. But the I think the real skilled Toro Piscine players use a kind of a Ricky Henderson slide. They tend to get the bull's attention and then move toward the pool in a kind of a tangent that's going to meet the bull. Go head first into the pool while the bull rumbles through and win that way.
I get the impression in reading Travels with Alice that you certainly enjoyed France, but not so much the French.
I have a little problem with the French. There's no question about that. I think all Americans have a little problem with the French, and I think the problem is because of expectations that aren't realistic. I think that Americans have somehow been given the impression over the years that French people are more or less like Maurice Chevalier, that is, a charming old coot who is any moment likely to break into a song like Sank Ebon Poor Little Girls. In fact, the only Frenchman who is that charming is Maurice Chevalier, and he lived in California. He was not in France at all. And the French, in the first place, are probably the most bureaucratic people alive. I mean, they invented the word, after all. That's a French word. So that almost anything you do in France consists of meeting somebody after standing in a line who is rustling around papers and trying to adjust his carbon paper and asking you questions like grandmother's maiden name, that sort of question. They're very interested in your grandmother's maiden name in France.
Do you know it?
No, I don't. I tell them whatever I want, right? I say de Gaulle, usually. What do they know?
I can't think of my grandmother's name.
Well, mine was de Gaulle, so I always use de Gaulle. They're kind of a sour people, the French, culturally. I tell my friend Lydie Marshall, who lives here, who's French, that I have met at least one French person I like, and it's Lydie. But I wouldn't push that too much. And I don't mean that there aren't individual Frenchmen who are, of course, lovely people. Anybody who wants to write letters can write Don Swaim about this, not me.
Still, they make pretty good food, not as good as back in Kansas City, you know, the chicken.
Right. They do make pretty good food. I would rather eat in Italy or in Chinatown. But
I bet they don't make good chili dogs.
They are bad on chili dogs. And, of course, you know, my younger daughter, Sarah, and I checked out the what they call fast food restaurants in Paris on the Champs-Élysées, where the fast food restaurants are pretty much taken over. The largest grossing Burger King is in Paris on the Champs-Élysées, patronized by French people, not by Americans. And
you mean Americans would go all that way from the United States to France and not eat a Burger King?
Well, I think maybe Americans, like my daughter, who had spent a few weeks in a small town in France and really would like something familiar, might stop in there now and then. But I don't think many Americans eat it in Burger King. I mean, I guess there's some there, but that's not what their main clientele is.
How is are the burgers at Burger King? They taste like American burgers?
I'm afraid so. I know so. And it's different partly in that it's called Burger King Maison du Wapier in France. And I was even surprised to find that the lines are pretty much like regular American lines, because most French lines, as you may know, are triangular, with the base of the triangle wherever business is being conducted, and the point way back as far as you can get from where business is being conducted.
What an interesting cue. No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Italian lines are oval. They don't have the triangle concept. I think it has something to do with Descartes, the reasons that their lines are triangular. English lines are quite linear. English lines, of course, they love lining up. You know, a lot of English people will do it just for fun. They don't even need to be buying anything. They'll just go and they'll stand in a bus line for a while and they'll get tired of that and then they'll go queue up for the cinema. They never actually do anything. They just line up.
Americans never line up. They kind of flock, except in banks where they are compelled to go through these...
Yeah, banks. Well, no, it's strange. They do line up in some places. I believe you'll find that if you go to 79th Street and East End Avenue, or maybe it's 79th and York first, right around there somewhere in Manhattan, you'll find young, rising professional investment bankers lining up for taxis. They actually have a taxi line there.
That's a regional custom, though, in that particular area.
Regional or cultural or something. They'll line up for taxis, which then go down to the entrance to the East Side Drive on 79th Street and go and carry them to Wall Street. I was just appalled when I saw them lined up for taxis. I mean, I just thought they had misunderstood where they were. I'm also told that the 79th Street Crosstown bus has a line on the east side. But if you try to get on the same bus on the west side, then it's like the last boat from Dunkirk. I mean, it's the usual entering the bus in New York.
Proves my point.
That
and geography.
Geography tells.
Yes.
Now,
right. You write a lot about Barbados, and there's an episode about Brussels sprouts. I can't understand how anybody could not love Brussels sprouts.
Well, actually, I don't mind Brussels sprouts myself. I sometimes go to the market on Union Square and get them on the tree. Have you ever done that?
No. They come on trees?
They come on trees.
I never knew where they came from.
You thought that they grew on shortish bushes.
No,
I know
I thought
that.
They were like potatoes. You dug them out of the ground or something.
Well, I don't know where the trees come from. Maybe you dig those out of the ground. But, I mean, they're called trees, but they don't look like a tree. It's kind of the same color as the Brussels sprouts, and they're just on all around that stalk. I guess stalk is a better word than tree. It makes a beautiful centerpiece of a Brussels sprout, and you might even want to eat one. I kind of like Brussels sprouts, but not the way the English cook them, because, as you know, the well-brought-up English person is taught to boil the Brussels sprouts for at least a month and a half in case one of the dinner guests shows up without his teeth. So they don't taste quite the same after a month and a half of boiling. This was in Barbados. When we arrived in Barbados, and Alice, my wife, otherwise perfect person, has the notion that you're supposed to eat in the hotel the first night you get someplace because you're tired. And Well, that would be fine, but Barbados has been in English hands for hundreds of years, and even now that it's independent, it's sometimes still called Little England. Not the sort of place I'd like to live, to eat in the hotel. The English spent centuries bringing the native populations all over the world the secrets of parliamentary democracy and cold gray meat, and I didn't want to eat any of that stuff. But we went, there was a kind of a buffet in the hotel that night, and it was gorgeous. I mean, the English are people who take real care with the appearance of special food, I mean, for special events. And they lose interest just before you put it in your mouth. Their interest peaks just before you eat it. And it was gorgeous, all sorts of ice sculptures and everything. I've always thought that's why there's so few British sculptors on the international art scene. Most of them are churning out sea bass out of ice. Mm-hmm. And I thought that if the sons of colonels in the Coldstream Guard had bar mitzvahs, this is what the reception spread would look like. And I finally came to Brussels sprouts, and I thought, well, the English have a lot to answer for. They really do. And it's astonishing to me that as the empire started to break up, and you saw those newsreels of people out in the streets yelling against the crown, that in addition to yelling things like "No more Raj" or "English go home," a lot of them must have been yelling, "No more Brussels sprouts. We've had it with the English."
But you were able to escape the hotel and explore Barbados restaurants.
Yeah, actually, I had, even though I was reminded by Alice that my previous attempt to find authentic native cuisine in the Caribbean had resulted in the discovery of bullfoot soup, which I said, well, I think it was authentic because it tasted pretty much what you'd expect something called bullfoot soup to taste like. And there was the undeniable presence of the foot. So I think it was authentic, but it wasn't really great. But in Barbados, we went to a place called Baxter's Road, where Barbadians or Bajans, as they're sometimes called, go late at night, and where a number of women cook fish. They fry fish over open fires. And best fried fish I've ever had in my life. Alice was astonished. She said, "What's in this fish? What's in this batter?" And the cook said, "That's my little secret, dearie." And so Alice never found out.
Bullfoot soup, is that related to baby foot?
No. It ought to be. There may be a kind of a leitmotif of feet in this book. Baby foot is what some people here call foosball. Some people call table soccer. It's a game of...
You can't eat it.
You couldn't eat it. I suppose you could eat it, but I had an uncle that used to gnaw on the furniture now and then. But I think you wouldn't want to eat it. You wouldn't want to serve it, certainly. It's a game that's played on what looks like the horizontal portion of an old-fashioned pinball machine. I mean, a machine about that size, except flat, of course. And has rods going through it, and the players are lowered from the rods so that when you twist the rods, you can propel a little ping-pong-sized ball toward the other goal. It's a soccer game. And... some people are very good at it. There is a player, for instance, who can flip the ball back with his defenseman, and as he's doing that, bring his goalie toward the ball and meet the ball with such ferocity that it goes through the entire field and into the opposing goal. And I am that player.
Didn't I read... that you played tic-tac-toe with a chicken? I think that happened in New York, of all places.
Yes. You're actually getting to all the great moments in sport in this book, Don. I actually didn't play the chicken. I usually take visitors to New York down to play the chicken. I always thought New York was a great walking city, partly because it's so compact. And we start in my house usually when there's an out-of-town visitor, and I live in Greenwich Village. And we go through the village, through the South Village, which, as you know, is an Italian neighborhood with a strong Portuguese admixture now, through Soho, kind of an awkward block or two in the machine tool district that's not terribly uplifting, then through Little Italy, and then to Chinatown. We have lunch in Chinatown, and then the visitor is permitted or given the opportunity to play tic-tac-toe with a chicken on Mott Street in the Chinese amusement arcade there. And if he wins, he is awarded, according to the sign on the game, a very large bag of fortune cookies. Well, it doesn't say very large bag, a large bag. I've never actually seen the bag because I've never been with anybody who won, but I would venture to say it's probably worth 35 or 40 cents.
Because you're not talking about a real chicken.
Yes, I'm talking about a real chicken.
You're talking about playing tic-tac-toe with a real chicken.
With a real chicken who's in a cage, and only costs 50 cents to play. And he's behind a glass, a piece of glass, but then there's writing on the cage, kind of those illuminated letters that you have in pinball machines. So it either says your turn or bird's turn. And it also has the X's or the O's that light up. And the chicken pecks from inside the cage behind the little screen. In fact, some people of great cynicism really, believe that there's some sort of computer that tells the chicken what to do. And other people believe it's a very smart chicken. My friend Frazier, who's talked about in this chapter, from Canada, was really appalled that the chicken got to go first. I was really disappointed that Frazier would bring that up. An advantage. It is an advantage, but as I pointed out to Frazier, it's just a chicken. Frazier came just short of saying, well, he gets to play all the time and I'm way out of practice. I haven't played for years. But he said, he gets to go first. And I said, well, Frazier, it's just a chicken. You're a human being. Surely there should be some advantage in that. Not enough, as it turns out, in Frazier's
case. So you know
case.
No one who's ever beat that chicken?
No. I've known some people to tie the chicken. Not Frazier. But I have been with people who tied the chicken. I've never been with anybody who beat the chicken. The chicken may be invincible.
Well, Calvin Trillin, I know you have another appointment to kind of wrap things up. You are a big advocate of awarding people who rarely receive the big prizes, like Lisa Mosca, I believe you write about in Travels with Alice. Do you believe that she should win the Nobel?
Well, yeah, I did. I actually nominated her for the Nobel Prize once for the perfection of her oysters. But she's no longer alive, Mrs. Mosca, alas. They gave it to Kissinger that year. So really, I really didn't have such a bad notion, I think. I think they should have taken my ideas a little more seriously.
What about other people that you know? I think you wanted to erect monuments and name bridges.
Well, Chicken Betty. Chicken Betty, the great pan fryer of chicken in Kansas City. I tried to get a bridge named after her. I wanted a major Missouri River crossing, not some little piddly bridge over the Blue River or something like that. And I tried to get the airport in Kansas City named after Arthur Bryan, whose family, more or less, or maybe Henry Perry. I would have been willing to go either way. Brought barbecue to Kansas City. Bryant Field, I think, sounds great. They decided to call it Kansas City International.
Now these are unsung heroes, and as opposed to people like Kissinger.
That's right. That's right. Now, who has done more for peace when you think about it, Mrs. Mosca or Henry Kissinger?
And Mrs. Mosca makes oysters, or did.
Did make oysters.
Baked oysters?
Baked oysters, Mosca, they were called. And also, I think she had a kind of a little garlic farm of her own down there in Waggaman, Louisiana, Mrs. Mosca. I once took a very late plane home from New Orleans after stopping in Mosca's, arranging to get stuck in the airport in New Orleans, and some friends of mine picked me up. We went out there and had quite a bit to eat. I caught the 10:30 flight and got to New York about 2 and crawled quietly into bed. And my wife said the next morning, she hadn't heard me, actually. I was very quiet, but she awoke toward dawn and had the feeling there was a wild animal in the room. It was Mrs. Mosca's garlic.
Well, Calvin Trillin, I know we could go on talking forever. Well, maybe not quite forever, but, you know, news people always exaggerate.
Right.
You know, the worst tornado in history.
That's right.
Worst flooding in Pennsylvania since mankind. But I know you have to go on to other things, as do I. Travels with Alice, another hilarious book from Calvin Trillin. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.
Hang on a second.